My name is Ed Goldberg, and I'm rattling the seats. But I do that in anticipation of introducing A.J. Jacobs. Welcome to KBOO and welcome to Portland.
Thank you for having me.
You're here touring on a book entitled The Guinea Pig Diaries, and it's published by Simon & Schuster. Let me tell people a little bit about you. Born in New York City, that's always a good thing.
Thank you. I didn't have much control, but thank you.
No, but if you did, you'd probably choose that, right?
Right.
He sees life as a series of experiments in which he immerses himself in a project or lifestyle, for better or worse, then writes about what he's learned. Fair statement?
That sounds good.
Okay. You've read all 32 volumes of the Encyclopedia Britannica, and then you wrote The Know-It-All, One Man's Humble Quest to Become the Smartest Person in the World.
True.
You also did The Year of Living Biblically. Now, I heard you on NPR for both of these things. You're on there quite a lot discussing your work. Is that correct?
That's true. That's true, yes.
We followed you right through the encyclopedia. I thought that was fun. You tried to live a whole year, the Year of Living Biblically, as all of the moral codes expressed in the Bible, all 613 commandments?
That's right.
Did you stone adulterers and stuff like that?
I was able to stone one adulterer. I used the pebbles. I used small stones, but I was able to do it.
This person admitted to being an adulterer?
Yeah, he came right out and said. I was dressed in my robe and sandals because I was really trying to get into character. And I was in the Central Park in New York, and he came up to me, a man, an elderly man. He said, "Why are you dressed like that?" I explained to him, "I'm trying to live all of the Bible, from the Ten Commandments to stoning adulterers." And he, right out there, he said, "I'm an adulterer. Are you going to stone me?" And that's how it happened. I said, "Sure, that sounds great." And I took the stones out from my pocket because I had been carrying...
You've been carrying them with you?
Yes, I've been hoping to run into an adulterer. And then he grabbed
New York
them.
City, I can't imagine why you would think that.
Well, I know. There are tons. If you just throw a rock, you're probably going to
hit one.
Yeah.
Okay, let me finish this up. You're also the author of The Two Kings, Elvis and Jesus. I really got to ask you about that. That's a 15-year-old book by now. And you did a comedic comparison of Elvis and Jesus. Comedic?
Well, it was based on Elvis Presley himself, who said that he thought he might be the second coming. So
right?
I just did a little investigation to see if it might be true. I don't think it was, but I did find some eerie parallels, like, you know, Elvis, Jesus was the Lord's shepherd, and Elvis dated Sybil Shepherd. So that was sort of the thrust of the book.
I also have it on good authority that... Jesus loved peanut butter and banana sandwiches.
I did not know that.
But he didn't fry them in bacon grease.
So that's a different. Yeah, that's right. Yeah.
Okay. Your life, I don't mean to say that this is not in a pejorative sense, but your life is basically a series of stunts, isn't it? You do these stunts and then you write about them.
That's it. That's it. And I have to say, I love it because, you know, as strange as the Bible one is, for instance, you know, throwing stones at adulterers and growing my beard far longer than yours, no offense. Mm-hmm. When I finished it, I had learned some incredible life lessons that stayed with me. And there are dozens. I'll just name one really quickly, which was this sense of gratitude. So I was, during the year, the Bible tells you to say prayers of thanksgiving. So I was saying prayers of thanksgiving all the time, dozens, hundreds of times a day. And it made me realize hundreds of things do go right every day that we totally take for granted. And we focus on the three or four that go wrong. So this has changed my perspective radically, and so that's why I thought, why not do a whole year where you try different experiments, see how those change me, for better or for worse. I mean,
I think one of the things that I really enjoy about what you've been doing and the stuff that's in this book, The Guinea Pig Diaries, is that you always manage to find the best of whatever it is you're doing, even if it's not necessarily an admirable thing to do. You find something in it that's good, and you know, you take a lesson from it.
Well, that's nice to hear. That is very nice to hear. Yeah, I try to find something redeeming, even in the ones that I disagree with. Even if, for instance, in the new book, there's a movement called Radical Honesty.
And it's Blanton guy, right?
Yes. Yeah. Have you had him on the show? He's a fantastic guest.
I don't be in the same room with the guy because I'll punch his lights out. So.
Yeah, this is a man who he started a movement, and he believes that you should never lie. But more than that, whatever's on your brain should come out of your mouth. Mm. No filter. It's almost like that movie, Liar, Liar. But and he does it, you know. When you're in the room with him, he'll say what he's thinking, you know, you're ugly, you have bad breath, whatever comes to his mind. So that has huge downfalls, that movement. But there are also things about radical honesty I found that I like. So I have adopted sort of a much more muted version of radical honesty.
Yeah, but what you've done then, in effect, is absorb it into your normal matrix of good manners and not wanting to hurt somebody's feelings. And so you're a little more honest about, you know, you'll tell somebody that he's got a grease spot on his tie. So that's nice, but it's nothing like what Blanton does.
Oh, no. Well, I could never do what Blanton does because he, you know, I tried it. I remember we were at a restaurant with my wife and we ran into some old friends of hers. And the friend said, oh, we should all get together. And I had to say, because I was in this experiment, I said, you know what? No thanks. I don't really ever want to see you again. You know, you seem nice, but I have no interest. And so that was horrible. You know,
sleep on the couch for about a month for that. Or...
there were some dagger eyes directed towards me. Absolutely. So yeah, I can't do that. But I've become much more radically honest about my own flaws. That's something I learned from Brad Blanton. You know, don't try to cover up your own flaws. Just be open about, you know, here I screwed up here, or I screwed up there. You know, I'm sorry. I will try to do better next time. But I messed up. It's kind of Obama. He's much more radically honest than Bush was about his flaws.
Well, the only way you could tell if Bush was lying is if his mouth was moving. So. Old joke, sorry. The idea of being radically honest, back in the 60s, there was when everybody was a little crazier than they are now, there were some people who thought that manners and, common courtesy was a right-wing plot to destroy, you know, the creative mind. And so they did this stuff, and they quickly found themselves without any friends. this is not always a good thing. You know, one of the things about society is that there are certain social lubricants that people use to keep from killing each other on the street. And one of them is the fact that you don't say everything that's on your mind.
It's true. And actually, I did an experiment in this new book on the exact opposite side of that, the sort of the exact opposite side of radical honesty, which is I tried to be the most polite person in the world, the most civilized. And I got my inspiration from George Washington, who is actually when he was a young man, he wrote a list of 110 rules of civil discourse. And it was all about being respectful of others and being polite. And by the way, it was also about not adjusting your crotch in public. That mm-hmm. was one of the 110 rules.
Shift,
number two.
Shift not your, what it is, shift not your...
Your unseen parts.
Unseen parts.
Something along those lines. Yeah. I'm glad you noticed that.
And, yeah. that's another one of the things in here is trying to live by George Washington's rules. Do you ever stop? I mean, reading your book, and I've heard you on the radio, and I say to myself, Gertrude Stein wrote the autobiography of Alice B. Toklas, and what she said about Oakland, California, was that there was no there. There was nothing that you could call a city, nothing you could call, certainly by East Coast standards. And I'm reading this saying, what is at the core of A.J. Jacobs? Why does he live by other people's rules, and why does he feel the need to do it? Is there an answer for that?
Well, So are you saying I'm the Oakland of a writer?
Well, I'm saying it's on that spectrum, yes.
I actually, what I do these because first of all, I find them fascinating and I love them. It's like taking a crash course in a whole new topic every month, something I'm passionate about. So whether that's religion or education with the encyclopedia book or the founding fathers with the Washington experiment, I get a crash course. But more than that, I found that the best way to improve your life is to experiment with it, that we get stuck in our ruts. And it's almost a brain thing that, you know, the neural pathways are almost become like ruts. And you have to shake things up. If you want to improve your life and live it to the fullest, be happy, you got to try new things. And this can be, it doesn't have to be living like George Washington. It can be small. I talk about in one of my projects about changing the toothpaste that I use, because I've been using the same toothpaste for 30 years, and I've only used it because some guy at camp, at my summer camp, started to use it, and then I started. I never thought about it, but you shake things up, you try new toothpaste, and I have a new toothpaste that I love, that makes it a joy. It tastes like orange mango, and it's like every day a little treat. And otherwise, I'd still be using the same medicinal toothpaste that I always hated.
You're probably too young to remember the bourbon and scotch flavored toothpaste in the 50s.
I never got a taste of that.
Sounds
delicious.
Do you know any sociology? Do you know the umbrella theory of sociology?
Which one is that?
That is the one that says when there are certain things that we do, and we do them regularly or do them without thinking because they make our life easier. For example, if every time it rained, you looked out and said, oh my God, what am I going to do? It's raining outside. This would cause you undue concern. It would make you, you know, crazy. But instead you say, oh, it's raining out, I'll grab the umbrella.
Right.
Right? So what you may define as ruts in your neural pathways are also ways to make your life easier. And some, you don't really need to challenge every facet of your life, do you?
Well, that's true in some cases, but in other cases, we do it out of habit, and it's a bad habit, and we're just doing it because we did it one time, and then we kind of got caught up in it, and trying to look at each decision that you make, I guarantee you it'll change your life for the better. You know, it's a challenge. Because doing the same thing is easier in a sense, but it won't necessarily make you happier.
Oh, that's true. Do you foresee at any time in the future saying, you know, I'm really tired of challenging myself every day. I think I'm just going to sit back and relax for a couple of years and be normal, quote unquote normal. Excuse me.
Well, I do get to be normal, you know, in between the projects. I'm not doing one after another, so I have plenty of time to be normal.
Because it seems that way in the book, really. You know, having done a year of biblical living, a year of reading this, I guess you could do other things besides reading Encyclopedia Britannica. But,
right. Well, I mean, a big part of these is researching the projects. So during that research, I'm just reading books about it. I'm not actually living it. So, you know, I got to, one of the projects is about trying to improve my marriage. So I got to read all about the history of marriage, and it was fascinating. One of my favorite facts from the history of marriage is that the phrase henpecked husband, a henpecked husband used to be illegal. If you had your wife tell you what to do, then you were violating the hierarchy, and you got in trouble. In colonial America, they would strap you naked to a cart, and a donkey would ride you around town to humiliate you and say, you know, you've got to be the man in the family. So it really is an interesting to see. It's a quite a sexist institution.
Yeah, and we're more civilized now. They just send you to the Promise Keepers to learn how to behave. let me remind our listeners that I'm speaking with A.J. Jacobs. Title of his book is The Guinea Pig Diaries, published by Simon & Schuster. Tell me about the, not the Two Kings one. Where was it? The one that I, let me go back for a second. Mensa. Was this before or after your encyclopedia?
This was during when I was writing The Know-It-All, uh-huh. which was about reading the encyclopedia. Right. I was trying to explore the limits of intelligence. So one of the things I did was I joined Mensa, and I went to a Mensa meeting, which was an absolute riot. It was a fascinating look at one of my favorite parts of the meeting was that on their name badges, everyone had a little
IQ.
Would have been a good idea.
Yeah. Okay, I'm guessing.
No, this one, they had little color-coded stickers, and green meant, yes, I will hug you. Yellow meant, ask before hugging. And red meant, no hugs at all. So it was interesting. They had really formalized the greetings.
This is like jelly bracelets in junior high school now, you know?
I've read about that. Right. So that's interesting.
Right. It wasn't like that when I was in junior high school.
The nerd version of jelly bracelets.
The nerd version.
But it was. I actually was very afraid because I kind of poked a little fun at Mensa, and I was worried that they would be offended.
What did they do? Hit you with a slide rule?
I don't think they even use that anymore.
Some of them do because it's, you know, the real way to go.
But they loved it. They were happy to be mentioned at all and put me on the cover of the Mensa magazine.
Oh, so, that's nice.
Yeah, I was very flattered.
I went to one Mensa meeting in my entire life, only one. And
did you join Mensa?
I didn't. And the reason I didn't join was I was profoundly bored for the entire evening.
Because they were,
boring? Well, I don't know what was boring. Most of the people didn't have a really winning personality. They look, the term nerd begins to describe what the way most of them were. They were all very nice, don't get me wrong.
Right.
There were a couple of people who sat in the corner with their shirts buttoned up to their necks and didn't do anything but glower at other people. But you find that, you can find that in any group. Each of them was so convinced of his or her own superior intelligence that they were doing you a favor by talking
right.
to you.
Right. No, I definitely, the level of social awkwardness, I don't think you can find higher social awkwardness than at a Mensa meeting. So that was, it was
an
interesting.
Asperger's meeting, maybe.
Yeah, there was, among the conversations, they talked about different words you can spell on your calculator when you turn it upside down. So that was kind of a topic.
Yes, I remember that.
Yeah.
Okay. This book has a lot of fun stuff in it. But here's something maybe you don't know.
What?
Washington and Spanish Fly, you mentioned that in the book.
Right.
Yeah. Do you know that when the Spanish Armada was defeated, that, who was it, Drake, who had the English ships?
Right.
Sent a message back to the Queen, and all it said was Cantharides, the Spanish Fly.
So he was implying that that she needed her.
No, he was just implying that the Spanish Fly. They fled.
Oh, I see. It was a little pun.
He was being clever.
It was a pun. Ah, very good.
I told AJ Jacobs something you didn't know.
I did not know that. That is a very good one.
Let's talk about something you do know. I found your chapter on outsourcing yourself to be maybe the most charming chapter of the book for many reasons.
Thank you, Ed.
Well, I think at least part of it is because of the wonderful people in India that you came in contact with who handled your life for you. Why don't you tell us about that?
Yeah, that was that started because I was reading about all these companies outsourcing all their low-end tasks. And I don't have a company. I'm not a corporation. But I do have a lot of tasks. So I was thinking, what if I outsourced my life? So I hired this team of people in Bangalore, India, and I had them answer my email and answer my phone. And they argued with my wife for me. And they read bedtime stories to my son. So it was a fantastic month because I just got to read books and listen to the radio, watch movies. So I loved it. But one of the things I loved was getting to know these people in Bangalore, because they, you never get to talk to them on a real level. They just answer your questions about tech and you get annoyed. But seeing it from the other side of you, seeing the human side of it was fascinating. And I think they, there's a lot of demonization of them because, it's very worrisome. I think that they are going to take a lot of jobs from America. But if you look at it from their point of view, they're wonderful people. They're very eager and they're supportive and they just want a shot at it. So I don't honestly know what the solution. One solution is that this man who read this piece, it was originally in Esquire magazine, and he told me that he actually had been laid off from his job. He was an American guy, and he hired one of the outsourcers to look for a new job for him. So he outsourced his job hunt, and she found him a job within a week. So maybe that's our solution, is to outsource our job hunts.
Why do I get the image of a snake eating its own tail?
It is a little bit like that.
Another thing that I was really, I thought this was a lot deeper. I mean, you kind of, go past it in the book because the object of the piece was not to investigate this, but you were photographed nude.
That is true.
And I think one of the things that it did was give you a concept of objectification that women go through all the time. Can you talk about that?
Absolutely. And that was the point of the piece, actually, is that I work at Esquire magazine, and my boss wanted to have Mary Louise Parker in the magazine, and he asked her to pose nude, and she said that she would, but only on the condition that the editor of the piece also posed nude, so he could see what it's like to be objectified.
She's a smart kid.
She's great. I love her. Unfortunately, I happen to be that editor. And so my boss said, you know, take off your pants and shirt and get in front of a camera. So that's what I had to do. And it was really interesting to notice the power dynamics between the camera, the photographer, and me, and how they, you know, they give you liquor, get you a little liquored
relaxed.
Up. They get you relaxed. They play the music, and you sort of get caught up in the moment. But there's always a power dynamic. And now I can't look at a nude photo without thinking about what was going on behind the scenes. How did this all come about? So it's really changed my perception of that.
There's something about being naked. You are literally defenseless when
you're
in that
true.
Condition.
That's true. Yeah, and you notice, about as vulnerable as you can be. And it was also a double-edged sword for me because, you know, I was very uncomfortable being nude. But at the same time, my human vanity got the worst of me. So there were all these cute photography assistants who were wandering around, and they were paying no attention to me whatsoever. Like, my nude form could be a wicker chair for all they care.
Well, they've seen it all.
I guess that's the problem. They've seen it all. So
if you were the first one, maybe you would have got a look or two. But you just, you know, six of you a day going through there. So,
so true.
Another thing I liked was impersonating a star, or impersonating an actor anyway. Noah Taylor is not what we would call a major international star, but he had his 15 minutes from the movie Shine.
That's right.
Where he played David Helfgott as a young man. Tell us how that worked out.
Well, that was, yes, when the movie Shine came out, he was an actor in it, and I happened to look exactly like him, especially at the time. I had my hair long, and I had big, thick, black glasses. Not a good look, by the way. We found out that the actor, who had gotten a lot of critical attention for this movie, he was not going to go to the Academy Awards. I was working at a magazine at the time called Entertainment Weekly.
And yes.
The idea was to send me in his stead so that I could go undercover as a movie star and see what it's like to be famous. Just, you know, experience a night of fame and adulation. And what was that like? What's it like? And I got to tell you, it was great. It was pretty amazing. But it was also dangerous because it warped my personality. I mean, I wasn't even a real star, and it warped my personality because I had so many people telling me how wonderful I was and asking me for interviews, and you know, anything I wanted was there for me.
Turned a boy's head, didn't it?
It did. It turned a boy's head.
Well, you imagine having to deal with that for real. I mean, you were in effect an imposter.
Right.
And you could get out of it the next day, and it affected you. Can you imagine listening to that crap all the time?
I know. It made me understand why a lot of celebrities turn into these, you know, schmucks. They are, one professor has called it acquired situational narcissism.
Uh-huh.
Because, you get in this, you're not normally that narcissistic necessarily, but you get in this and no one's saying no to you, and you just become a monster.
I began to think, as I was reading this and having heard you over the years with your various projects, what's the limit? What if, you know, what if an editor came to you with a story about cannibalism or human, or human sacrifice? Where's your limit, AJ?
I think I do have quite a few limits. Some readers have suggested that I do all the positions in the Kama Sutra. And actually, that one, my wife had the limit.
I hope your major medical is paid up.
That's true. It's a lot of stretching, right?
It really is, yeah.
It could hurt. Yeah, no, my wife put the kibosh on that one. So there, that's the thing. My wife has a lot of veto power over these projects. So there was another one I was interested in trying to test the limits of technology, because we all communicate so much through technology. So what it would be like to cut out all human contact and just interface through Facebook and instant messaging and in other words,
become a typical middle school child in America.
Exactly.
People do that every day.
Well, I was not allowed to do it. My wife told me no. That we are we had my niece's bat mitzvah coming up. She said, "You're not going to video Skype your way to my niece's bat mitzvah. You are coming in person." So I guess I'll have to leave it to the younger generation to do through that project.
We have maybe 2 minutes, 2.5 minutes left, and I need to ask you about your wife. I don't think she's long-suffering. I think that she's achieved some level of satori about this. You know, she's, you know, she's a higher being of some kind. She's achieved a level of Zen acceptance about what you do. Is that a fair guess?
That could be a fair, yeah. She really is. I think you've got her nailed. She in fact, though, in the last chapter, I did feel that I owed her for all that I had put her through. So the last project is where I try to be the ultimate obedient husband and try to reverse the traditional gender role in marriage. And that was a fascinating. I think she did love that. That was her favorite project ever, because one of the things was, you know, I realized that we do carry over these 19th century views of marriage. You know, even though my wife and I both work,
but they're older than the 19th century. They go back a long way. This gender role thing in marriage.
Right.
Yeah. Sorry, I interrupted you.
No, not at all. You're right. But realizing something as simple as the fact that the liquid soap dispensers in the bathroom, they don't magically refill. This was a shock to me.
That's my job in our house.
Oh, really?
Yes.
Well, that's good. So do you feel you have an equal marriage?
No, I think that she still probably does 60 to 65% in any given time.
But that's pretty good compared to most marriages.
Well, it is. You know, I do my own laundry. I vacuum, do things like that. But still, when push comes to shove, she handles most of it. And I think she's... I guess she likes it that way, because she could certainly order me around if she wants to.
Well, if you ever want to do something fascinating, but that will change your life, do you just make a list of everything that she does and you do? And now that my wife has it in black and white, I can never go back to my lazy ways, because she'll be like, no, you're doing this. So it's dangerous if you're a lazy person, but it's really interesting.
You also have children. Has this affected their lives in any way?
When I had a huge beard during my biblical year, and then I shaved it off, my son didn't know who I was.
Wow.
So that was, but other than that, they actually seem to enjoy it, because they get to learn along the way as well.
So you work for Esquire magazine.
That's true.
Which is certainly a step up from Entertainment Weekly, which I've been subscribing to it for years, but it's pretty vapid.
They were very nice to me.
Esquire was at least printed articles in fiction from people who can actually write and actually think.
I do. I feel so lucky to be working there. Yeah, it's great.
What's next for you? I mean, do you have the desire to be a novelist? Do you want to write a screenplay? Do you want to tread the boards and be an actor? I mean, where does A.J. Jacobs really live?
Well, I am going to try one more of these big experiments, see how it goes. I'm going to try to be the healthiest person alive, because I feel that's the final part of this puzzle. I tried to improve my mind, tried to improve my spirit. Now I'll try to improve the body. And once that happens, you know, perhaps I'll die in the middle of it, which would be kind of good for the publicity. But if I survive, then I'm going to step back and reassess and try to figure out what to do next. Maybe I'm interested in, you know, new media, the television. Who knows? Maybe can I be a radio host?
You probably could. It doesn't require much talent. I'll tell you that. It's my year as a gym rat. Is that what it's going to be?
Basically.
Okay. It's really been fun talking to you. I've been speaking with A.J. Jacobs. Title of his book is The Guinea Pig Diaries, published by Simon & Schuster. If you're not completely destroyed by your year of living healthily, please come back and talk to us.
I would love to. Thank you, Ed.